It is Saturday, September 3rd, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio KUSP. In the first half of the show, we'll be doing Geek Week News. In the second half, we'll be doing Geek Week News. That's right. Geek News the whole time, but we do have a giveaway in the middle of the show, and Ben will be introducing that in just a second. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's song is Through Being Cool by Devo. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy, sometimes Stanford instructor, and media designer for Tandy Beals here at Cabrillo on next weekend.
Hello, hello.
How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing well.
So tell me about the show.
This is a really fantastic show. We've done it
That's your own opinion.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'll only present the objective facts now. So it's going on at the Cabrillo Crocker Theater September 9th through 11th, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the show is about exploring death and what happens after death, what maybe doesn't happen after death, posing those questions, not trying to answer them. And getting people to think about it, and objective.
What are you doing in the show? Are you a media designer? What is that?
Well, one fun thing about the show is it's not a typical piece of theater or dance or video. It's kind of all three of those things, all four of those things, music as well, mixed all together and kind of squished together and blurring the lines between all these things. So I'm in charge of basically getting all of the media up and working.
So there's projectors in the show?
Yeah, there are five projectors in the show.
Five. That's not bad.
Yeah.
And I saw last year's production of this, yeah. And I was kind of involved in the very first production in the sense that that's how we met, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so this show is kind of important, I guess, to you and me because we met through it. But yeah. One of the things that you're doing is you have actors interact. Some scenes are the actors doing roles, and then sometimes you have a projection, which is as much of the focus as the actors, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The projection,
the audience switches between the experiences.
Yeah, the projection definitely is some of the characters.
What's some of the technical problems in doing that kind of thing?
Oh gosh,
size is the biggest thing for me. Like, how do you get your video people to be the same size as your stage people?
Just have a big enough screen and put the projector far enough back, right? Well, no, actually, the biggest problem is budget, right? Yeah. I mean, how do you put on? So last year we had a pretty tight budget for what we pulled off, and we had three rear projection screens, one front projection screen, and this year we have one additional rear projection screen. But last year we didn't have any of that equipment, and so we were just borrowing from people.
Begging.
We were renting little things, yeah, just begging everywhere we could possibly find it. We got a bunch of people who helped us, who are awesome people and companies. But this year it's nice because we actually have a good, foundation of equipment that we were able to purchase through some grants and things like that.
Some of the great things about rear projection, of course, in stage work is you can have your actors right in front without having the projector hit them.
Exactly. There's a
like
moment
an
of
Apple
the
speech, right?
Yeah. There's a moment of the show where these people and these projections are just popping up in these different boxes. And in some cases, especially before you realize exactly where the screens are, you don't really know what's real, what's reality, what's virtual. And again, like, it's kind of blurring that line. We actually have interaction between projectors and between projections and video and actors. And anyone who's done any kind of theater show with media or sound knows how that can be very difficult.
It is.
Yeah, computers.
Of course, I do that. It's my job professionally to help people with that sometimes.
True.
So yeah, it's neat to see you going through that experience. Anyway, let's go on with some more geek news. First off, it's here after here. It's next weekend at Cabrillo Crocker Theater. Is it Crocker Theater?
The Cabrillo Crocker Theater, yeah.
And we're giving you tickets away?
We're giving two tickets away, a pair
of
tickets.
Of the show.
So pay attention.
Pay attention, right? Well, this is like some kind of quiz thing. Of course, we have to figure out how to do that in the middle of the show, but we can.
And if you're listening via podcast, we're sorry.
Okay, so the first story I want to talk to you about, Ben, and I'm actually excited to tell you about this, has to do with passwords and the idea of like a haystack kind of password idea.
Haystack.
Do you know this idea?
Oh, that's my password, haystack.
Oh, no.
If you want to learn about passwords, go back and listen to our
password
epic,
show. Yeah.
Epic password.
The big thing
show.
That I want to talk to you about is that you normally have some kind of algorithm that you use in your brain to figure out your password for something like Amazon. And the idea is that if you have a password phrase that's pretty good and you mix it in with the domain you're at and you do it in such a way that somebody, by looking at the password, if they figured it out, couldn't figure out that you use that same rule for every site, then you can pretty safely, you're kind of using the same password for every site.
And kind of.
Yeah, it's a tricky little thing you try to do.
From within your brain, you're using the same password. It's just...
You're memorizing the same thing.
Yeah, you have a little equation.
So let's remember, let's think of the password really... the sun is so beautiful. So that's your password, right? And then you go to Amazon and you'd say, Amazon, the sun is so beautiful. So now you've got a password that's unique to Amazon. But if someone at Amazon happened to hack the system and read your password before they encrypt it in their system, they'd see, oh, it's Amazon. Oh, and his email address is at Gmail. So I'm going to go log in with Gmail, the sun is so beautiful. And now all of a sudden I've got access to Ben's password. So you can't, so that's not a safe way to have a password. You should have a unique password, but some way that if it does get discovered, not all your passwords are discovered.
Well, I would make the argument that, I mean, you can make it so your password is obscure enough that you can't crack it without at least two data points, probably three or four.
Right.
Like, for example, if my password is
So what you do is you munge that up.
D-Y-S-T-C, you know, some random combination of characters, and then maybe the third or the fourth character in my password is the second character. So M for Amazon.
Right.
A-M,
so this is a great example. You know. So in this situation, instead of saying Amazon, my son is so beautiful for the sun is so beautiful for your password for Amazon, you'd say the sun is so beautiful, but you would put M in the middle of the word beautiful, and that would be the second. Right, something that you know and you can do every time, but makes it nice and unique. I think Charlie's going to participate in this discussion. Hey, Charlie, how's it going?
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I don't have headphones. I can't hear you.
No, we're good. You sound beautiful.
No, you've been doing a really good job with this password thing, and so I've been thinking a lot about it myself.
Uh-huh.
And one thing I came up with, because I've been using a really cool program called TrueCrypt, and it's a freeware, open source type of software that if you have like a flash drive and you have information on there that you want to protect, this is by far the easiest way to do it.
So what you're doing, I guess, is saving all your password and stuff to a flash drive, and you're actually encrypting that and unencrypting that flash drive.
Yeah, I'm not actually using it for passwords yet, but I'm using it for Dr. Dawn's medical information.
So private data.
Private data.
I do the same type of thing. I actually keep when I want to encrypt data that's larger than just text, I put it inside a DMG on a Mac and encrypt that DMG. So it's a disk image that I can move around.
Exactly.
And then you can sync. I have that whole document synced with something like, Dropbox service, right? So anytime I log in, I can go get that DMG and unencrypt it. That same idea, you're basically making an envelope of encryption.
Exactly.
So what I want to talk about is the password itself.
But I just want to say something about so they wanted you to use a really long password for this. And so the trick I came up with is a line from a song that I know really
well. Yeah.
And it's very long.
And the one thing you want
25 characters or something.
Yeah. See, if you go up to 25 characters or something, Ben, you were laughing at me earlier typing in my password. I have an extremely long password on my computer because I'm trying to
memorize 500 characters.
I think it's 22 characters, something like that. Yeah. And I'm trying to, what I'm doing is I'm using that as my lock screen and everything on my Mac. It's kind of frustrating, but I'm getting really good at memorizing my
password. Yeah, you had to try three times.
I did have to try three times, but it was early and I hadn't totally processed my caffeine for the day. But in any case...
So you need caffeine to access your machine,
Oh, man, if I had a flu or something, I wouldn't be able to get into my machine. It was so frustrating.
You'd be laying in bed, unable to do anything.
I think a song phrase is great. The one thing I would add to that is change something in there. Have uppercase, lowercase, and definitely have some special character. Once you've done that, you are a song phrase that's nice and long. It's great. The only problem, of course, with that is it's hard to use it all the time, right? If you have to check your email and you have to enter that every time, that's going to drive you insane.
Right.
So there's a level of confusion. Okay, so... The thing I want to talk about is Steve Gibson. No, you want to stay, Charlie? You're welcome to stay. But no, okay.
Gotta
Thank
go.
You, Charlie. Charlie See is you. The producer of Dr. Don's wonderful show and a good friend of our show. So, Steve Gibson, Security Now, it's one of the Twit network shows. Mm-hmm. I got hooked on it. It's a great show.
Twit, This Week in Tech.
This Week in Tech.
Yeah, and, Leo Laporte, all those cool people.
One of the things he does is a weekly discussion with Steve Gibson. Now, Steve Gibson wrote the application SpinRite, which is like a low-level hard drive recovery tool. I like the tool. I've used it. It's saved, not me, because I'm really good at backup, but friends of mine. But what I want to talk about is he has figured out, wouldn't it be great if just like your paradigm, little switching thing around that you do, that you memorize a password, and when you go to Amazon, you use the M because the second letter, that kind of that kind of algorithm that you do in your head. Wouldn't it be great if there was actually a cryptically strong way to do that? Meaning that every single website you go to, the password is, you know, 12 characters. It's really strong. It is 12 characters up in lowercase. So it's something you could memorize if you wanted to. But more importantly, it's actually an algorithm that you use of the word Amazon. Let's say if you wanted to log into Amazon, you would use the word Amazon with this piece of paper, and the output of that would be 12 characters that would be completely unique and very strong. And so what he's created is a Latin square. Now, everyone's familiar with the game Sudoku. Sudoku.
Oh.
You know Sudoku, right?
No. Latin square.
That's awesome. Sudoku is a 9x9 grid of numbers. And the game itself is, it's partially filled out with numbers. And the rule is in every row and every column of the game, there can only be one of the zero through, or I think it's one through nine digits. Yeah, one through nine digits. And you put them in the place so that you never collide. So rows and columns. And also Sudoku has another complication where it's actually broken into three subsquares. That's not true with Latin squares. But a Latin square is a pattern like that. Sudoku is like a Latin square if you ignore the restriction of those smaller squares. So you're saying that in every row and every column, there can only be one of the digit. It doesn't repeat. So now do that. What he's done is he said, okay, let's make a 26x26 grid. Every letter in the alphabet, right? There's 26 letters in the alphabet, right?
Yeah.
This alphabet.
Well, yeah.
Okay. So he takes this thing. It generates a Latin square, which means every row and every column, there's only one letter that doesn't repeat. So let's say that in the top row of this grid, there's an A in the second place. So it goes, you know, QA. And then in that A doesn't exist anywhere else on that row or that column, up or down. It doesn't exist anywhere else. So now you want to find out what your password is. You take your A for Amazon. You go to A. Then you go down the row until you run into the M in that row. Up or down the row, doesn't matter, right? Once you find the M, then you go left or right in that column to find the A. And you spell out the word Amazon. When you finish doing that, the location that you are is unique to the word Amazon, right? You're not going to get to that location by doing a shorter word or longer word. You could get to that location with a different word completely, randomly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you've gotten there with the word Amazon. Now from that location, you go again, starting with, you find the next, you're on A, so you start with Amazon, you're on N. So you, from there, find the A in that column. And wherever that A is, the letters next to that, those two letters, you write those down. That's the beginning of your password. Then you go to M, up or down, you find M. What you do at the very end is you find a unique, this piece of paper that you've got, that you've printed out, that you've created, that was created by software. You now, if you do that with Amazon, you get a 12-character code that can only be generated by this square. So you have a piece of paper, non-computer technical thing, that will generate a 12-digit off of 6 digits. And 12 digits strong enough, upper, lowercase. This thing happens to be randomly upper and lowercase characters, so you're going to get a mix.
Wow.
And the cool thing about that is that you don't have to memorize your password. All you have to do is have this piece of paper.
And some time.
And a little time. It is kind of time.
And maybe some privacy too. I mean, you know, someone could watch you cracking. I mean, the thing about my little algorithm is my password is not, what was the example you gave? Like, I love something, something.
Yeah.
It's not a bunch of dictionary words, you know? Mm-hmm. It's some kind of, it's.
Well, keep in mind, a dictionary attack when you're getting up to the long phrases isn't really viable.
Well, what we were saying is you take...
Sorry, just a second. A dictionary attack means if you use a word like panther, and that's your phrase, every time someone wants to try to crack your password, they're just going to go through the entire dictionary and look at every word, try every word, and eventually they're going to find any word that's in the dictionary. So you can't use words that are in a dictionary. Mm-hmm. And then people also go, well, people like short passwords, so they use panther, but then they change the last E to a 3. So now what we'll do is we'll just do start redoing replace. We'll go through the dictionary 700 times, and we'll use different combinations of those first words.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, using a dictionary word with even deviance doesn't work.
Yeah, but
that's
but
a dictionary attack.
But if my password is I love computers,
yes,
and then it's so for Amazon, let's say, so I take a M, I take the M, and I put that somewhere in there, and I end up with I love computers or something.
Okay, sure.
A human would say, hey, that M is misplaced.
Right.
And then you might be able to figure it out that way, right?
But if you've saying is you're doing kind of a random string,
yeah,
you're not going to know. Now, I agree.
Exactly.
I agree.
So,
but the point is that...
But it's not as good as yours,
right?
Except that it's way faster.
Okay. So and the clever thing about this is that also is that your passwords is complicated for a human brain to figure out your pattern. But for a computer, it's not actually that hard.
True.
So what they could do is they could go, well, we know, for example, since you've secretly, since I've told everybody that you've got this kind of idea, is if of your websites, one of the websites that you use your passwords for, if they go, oh, Ben uses some kind of combination off our domain, and they write a piece of code that steps through and tries to log into your Gmail account with that kind of knowledge, they'll get to it.
Yeah, but I mean, there's always...
It's not a big concern.
Well, first of all, it's the low-hanging fruit that the attackers go for.
The person that's using Panther for the password is
or password for their password.
Wouldn't you love the idea that right now there's somebody out there going, my password is Panther.
Oh, no. How do you know? He's talking to me.
You really need to do that every show. If your password is password is music, you better change it.
Yeah. Or if you have there was some episode of CSI or something where you see maybe I'm confusing. Scully is part of CSI? No, Scully is part of X-Files.
X-Files, yeah.
Okay. I think there was an episode of X-Files where like you saw Scully type in her password or whatever. And that's like one of the most popular passwords is Scully's password from that episode.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because X-Files was so widely watched. Man. So if that's your password.
So the cool thing about this idea, I think it's actually a little hard to use. But the cool thing about this is that let's say you use this thing to generate your passwords. And let's say you use a password manager, like something that I use. I use 1Password on my computer. Mm-hmm. So my passwords are actually encrypted with a long phrase on my computer. But when I unencrypt it, I can fill out any form pushing a button on my browser. It's really cool. So I don't actually know my passwords, right? My passwords are randomly generated strings that get inserted by this application that are really strong. So, because I use like as long as I use the longest field I can for the password. So guessing my passwords just isn't possible. But if my machine has a problem and I can't get into my machine, now I happen to have it synced on my iPhone as well, and there's actually a syncing, so I'd have to lose my iPhone and my laptop, and then not be able to get to my backups that I've got. If that all happens, I am locked out of my accounts. Right? Mm-hmm. I can't get into them. If instead of doing this in this kind of random, pseudo-random way, the machine helps me, instead I had a piece of paper that I could generate my passwords from, and I was using that every time I generate my passwords, now, if all technology fails completely, as long as I can get that piece of paper, I have my passwords to my Gmail account that I can't get access to because I have no computer. But you get the point.
Yeah.
The article's up on geekspeak.org at the end of the show. Off the grid, haystack, paper encryption, Steve Gibson, really cool guy. And I highly suggest the show. In fact, I've got one more story that comes from that podcast. So I'm just stealing from them today. Isn't that horrible?
Yeah, that's awful.
But Ben, talk about space.
Well, I just want to say that if you happen to lose where might you keep this piece of paper? Probably your backpack, right?
That's a good question. I mean, so there's a couple things you want to do.
If
first
you
off,
lose your
you
iPhone.
Print a couple copies of it, okay? Uh-huh. And this is one of the things that I've always wanted to be able to do. So you print a couple copies of it.
No, get a tattoo
So you print a couple pieces of paper. You print a few copies of this. One, you put in your safety deposit box. One, you save somewhere wherever your passport is locked up, right?
Yeah.
Maybe in your Facebook. The other one of them you put in your wallet and hope that no one uses it when you lose your wallet. A lot of them that you cut into four and you give one to your mom and one to your friend Ben, one to your friend Miles, and one to your girlfriend. And then if something happens to you, those four people are like, oh, Lyle just got in a coma or he broke his back and is at Stanford for 2 weeks healing. Let's go, but he needs to access his bank account.
But that gives all of us veto power.
All of you would have to agree to get into my accounts. Once you do that, you can get into my accounts, which is exactly what I'd want if something bad happens.
Yeah.
Right? It gives that ability for me to hand out access to my passwords in case of emergency without losing any kind of... I mean, there's a bit of loss of encryption if I give you 1/4 of my hash, if you will.
Not a huge one.
Not nearly. It could increase the potential for...
Orders of magnitude better than anything
else. So there's some great benefits to that idea. Also, the idea that your password's at the bank... something's at a safety deposit account, and that's a physical thing that represents all your passwords, is a pretty cool thing that we aren't able to do normally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's go on to supernovas, please. Talk about
big explosions. Explosions bigger than the Earth. So there was recently a supernova that went off in the galaxy M101 in Ursa Major.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I often visit there. And it's a type 1A supernova. And a couple of really cool things about this.
So you said in M1, M101 galaxy. You talked about it being in a constellation.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's that area of space from Earth. It's past that though. It's past the local star systems, which we see. You can't see it by the naked eye.
You can't.
You said it's in Ursa Major. It's not. It's I always find it frustrating. People say it's in a certain space. It's actually
you need to tell, really far away. You need to tell people which direction to point.
In the direction that Aversa measures.
And it's probably close. I'm not sure of this, but I think it's probably closer than a lot of the stars in Aversa Major. So, I mean.
I know. I've seen most of the stars you can see are in our galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is another galaxy. This is a lot farther away.
Okay.
Okay. Go on. So, well, M101. Galaxy far away.
So.
A long time ago.
In a galaxy far away, yeah. So anyway, this star went nova. This supernova, it's a type 1A supernova. And it's pretty cool because, first of all, it's really close in galactic terms, mm-hmm. I should say. 21 million light years away. So that's not all that far away, especially for a supernova.
Yeah.
You know, like supernovas don't usually...
Do we witness the entire experience, the whole thing?
For the most part, yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So we knew it was a candidate. We had imaged it before, a couple of years before, and through a couple different telescopes. And then it went, and one of the telescopes was like, huh, something just changed, and pointed their telescope over there, and then sent out the alert, and everyone pointed their telescopes there, Hubble and everyone. And we're catching, so I should say, it takes a really, really long time for a supernova to explode. It's not just like, okay, it's exploded. You know, really? It's like days,
right?
That this is exploding in.
Well, the matter is all constrained to the speed. You know, it's going slower than the speed of light. So
yeah.
It can't be that fast.
Yeah. And we actually caught it within a day.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. And we actually caught it where you could see pieces of unexploded star flying away.
Neat.
Now, I'm using the word see lightly because you can't just zoom way in on this and see like, oh, look, it's a chunk of debris. No, but you know, like through imaging all of this and everything, these are some of the things that they concluded.
What's really interesting about a star, I'm interrupting you, I'm sorry. What's interesting about a star is that the reason why the star is not just expanding rapidly in all directions is because there's too much gravity holding it together. Uh-huh. So if you took a chunk of star, if you will, and you moved it away from the star, it would expand extremely fast by itself. That's what the explosion is, if you will, the supernova. What happens is that...
Well, it's a nuclear detonation.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it changes its density and therefore expands.
Yeah, actually what happens is you get past a specific mass, 1.3 something. Oh, man.
It's okay.
This is upsetting. I can't remember the exact number. God. It's an important number to have.
You need to get a physics degree.
The like chakram mass or something. It's like 1.38 or something.
These kind of terms, you're wondering, wait, am I using a Star Trek term or a real term?
Yeah, that's actually, that is a problem.
Are they using a Star Trek term or a real term?
That's a serious problem I have.
Okay, so you get to a certain point, what happens?
You get to 1.38 solar masses, the Chandrasekhar limit, right?
Okay.
And it just explodes because, you know, you've reached the point where it reaches a critical temperature and then you get an explosion because it electron degeneracy.
Okay, we're leaving some stuff out here because, of course, the size of the star, the mass level of the star can depend on diameter too. So you're talking about...
Yeah, I'm about to get that.
Okay,
which is specifically type 1A supernovas are white dwarfs, right? So you've got this white dwarf. It's accruing mass slowly, and... at some point, it reaches 1.38 solar masses, and it just goes like that.
It's the opposite thing. Oh, it increases mass. Okay, gotcha.
It increases mass. It
so
reaches.
What you're saying is that our sun can never go supernova because it's one solar mass.
It's also not a white dwarf.
Right. Go on.
Yeah. Anyway, lost my train.
So it accrues all this mass. It gets
yes.
That
okay.
Point.
So what I was trying to say is one of the really cool things about Type 1A supernovas is they always, almost always go at 1.38 solar masses, and they're all white dwarfs, which means that when they go, they are a very specific brightness, which means that you can use these type 1A supernovas as basically like the calibration point for distance and for brightness, right?
Right.
So you've got all these supernovas going all over the place, and you can figure this out because they all are exactly the same brightness. So it's pretty cool. But anyway, the reason I'm bringing up this specific supernova is because right now, if you're lucky, you can go out and you can actually see this with a good pair of binoculars.
No way.
Yes way.
So there's an example of a star in another galaxy that you can see right now.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's one star, and I think it's actually brighter than the center of the galaxy that it's in.
So you're going to be looking
bright.
You're going to be looking in the area of Ursa Major. So you got to figure out when Ursa Major, if it's even visible in the hemisphere you're in at this time.
Well, actually, I mean, if you have one of those telescopes that like points itself manually or whatever, or you can use a star chart to find the galaxy it's in, to find M101,
right.
It's 59 arc seconds west and 271 arc seconds south.
Right. Just and the question is wherever you are, is that going to be at night? Because that would help.
Well, actually, the biggest problem, the reason, so if anyone wants to do this, go out tonight. Yeah. Don't go out tomorrow night, the next night or whatever, because we've been able to see it for a couple nights, but the moon is starting to become an issue, right? So as soon as the moon is, you know, a quarter moon or a full moon, or you're not going to be able to see anything.
But you can see it from the northern hemisphere?
Yes, you can. Actually, that's the best place to see it from is the northern hemisphere. So really, really cool stuff. And also, it's the nearest Type 1A supernova that we found since 1986. So it's not like this happens every day. It's pretty cool.
That's very cool.
6-inch telescope is roughly what you would need. So,
all right.
Pretty cool stuff.
So GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Learn more online at RamirezDDS.com. In a second, Ben's going to give you a quiz for the tickets for Here After Here about the news that we had. But and Ben, I think that submit the answers, the first person to fill out the contact form on GeekSpeak, because we don't have Rick
That's
today
true.
Before we can't take phone calls. So
sounds good.
If you've got the answer to what Ben's about to ask, you got one, Ben?
I do.
Okay, good. Then you can win the tickets to Here After Here, which happens next week at the Crocker Theater. It's a Tandy Beal production. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, and my name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Mr. Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy. For the geek bit today, I want to mention a little application for your iPhone and iPad with the camera. It's called Starwalk. It's free. And what it does is it uses the camera of your phone, the GPS information, and your rotation and pitch to determine where your camera is looking. It has a star map information on it. And you run this app and you aim up at the stars. And superimposed on the view that you can see of the stars are the stars with the names and information about them. And you can click on them and actually get more detail. So this might be a good tool to use to try to find this M101 supernova that just happened.
Did you say that was iPhone or Android?
iPhone. I don't know.
Android has one, I know.
And I'm sure that later in the show, we'll know what that is.
Google Star Map, I think it is.
Okay, cool. Some great
search for
great
Google
tools.
And Star and you'll find it.
Awesome. And we'll, you know what we'll do is we'll search for those and we'll put them up on geekspeak.org. Mr. Ben Jaffe, what is the quiz that, now keep in mind, you go to geekspeak.org, you fill out the contact form, you put in at the top in that subject line, quiz answer or whatever, and you'll get the Here After Here tickets, as long as you're the first person to answer this question correctly. And the question, of course, is going to be based off the news of the first half of the show.
Yes. All right. So the question is, and actually, I'm changing the question. The question was going to be, what's the name of the galaxy that the supernova was in?
But you just
said it like five times.
M101.
Yes. How many light years away is it?
That's the thing you could actually look up right now on Wikipedia. Do M101.
Maybe on Wikipedia.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe. It might not be on Wikipedia.
But the other
you
thing,
never know
the other
with
thing
Wikipedia.
The other thing that's important, of course, is that you said it earlier in the show.
I did.
All right.
Yes.
We're taking those questions via email. Now, this might be a question that you have to rewind the show to get, which means that you might have to wait till the podcast is up, and it will first come online about a half an hour after the show. You can get to the audio file at geekspeak.org. All right, my next news story has to do with a little problem that has emerged in the world of routers. And this story, again, is about... is from Security Now. I love the show. I'm kind of addicted to it right now. And what the issue is this. At home, you probably have a DSL router or a cable router. Sometimes these are called modems, and you have a router on top of that. And lots of times on the show, we talk about security patches. We mention that if you do have a device in between your modem and your computer that's a router, you're really protected, because what's happening when an infected machine, a worm type of machine, comes and scans for your computer, it sees your router and it can't actually get to the vulnerabilities of your computer. So like a Windows 95 machine, for example, if you plug it on into into a network that is not protected this way, it'll get infected within like 4 hours and it's all over from there. So the idea is to always have a router in place. And normally this is a great recommendation. Unfortunately, it's become clear that a lot of modem router manufacturers have been enabling a protocol called UPnP, which is Universal Plug and Play. It's a protocol that a lot of Microsoft Xbox uses. And this thing is really great because UPnP means that you can plug a few things in your network and they can all talk to each other. So if you've got like a TV that has UPnP support that also has, and then your computer has as well, the TV can potentially see your media folder on your computer. And there's this great ability to just plug in. Pretty soon you're browsing your media files through your TV, or your TiVo is browsing your computer. And a lot of that's done, if it's not done with Apple Tech, it's the Apple technology, it's done with UPnP, Universal Plug and Play. And the Xbox actually does a lot of concerns, waves flags about it not being open and not being able to be editable. The problem is that a lot of router manufacturers thought, hey, you know, your local network should have UPnP support because that'd be useful. But wouldn't it be nice if there was also management of your WAN? And that way, if someone has a smart device plugged into the other port, the public-facing port, we'll just be able to modify IP ports and reassign stuff on the fly. And unfortunately, it's extremely easy to do this. So if you've got like a Linksys computer that you haven't installed a new BIOS on.
Router, excuse me.
Well, you know what? It's funny. A Linksys router actually has Linux operating system in it. So it's kind of a computer. A person can scan it, detect it, say, hey, what's your information, and reassign ports. Not a good thing to do. Mm-mm. Unfortunately, the solution to this is complicated.
So that's kind of like...
There's a couple of solutions to it. But
it's kind of like someone coming and changing the lock on your front door so they can open it, maybe?
Yeah. Or
going
up to your front door and saying, hey, front door, will you please open the sliding back door? Oh, thank you. And then leaving. So then they come around the back. Yeah, it's exactly that.
Oh, jeez. Like,
unlock all the windows kind of thing. So what you really want to do, and I want to stress this, unless you really understand routers very, very well and you're a geek, you do not want to have any administrative rights on the WAN port. You want to have the WAN ports closed off, if you will, for administration, including, and if you're not using UPnP, Universal Plug and Play, turn it off, disable it. Both those things will help you. The other thing you can do, which I recommend if you've got a Linksys router, is go ahead and go install a new firmware. Tomato is a great one, and DDWRT is a great one. These are new Linux kernel router management tools that have a lot more features than Linksys out of the box, and I think they're awesome. I use them at my home.
I've got lots
of routers talking to each other. Well, it's like a home, but it's a property.
How
of
much
like
do you game? I use them at my base.
I don't game enough. Mm. But my games were always paper and pencil.
Yeah. And if you didn't understand that news story, then don't do anything to your router at all.
No. That's the thing, is that it's vulnerable.
But how can
you?
Get
a geek to do it.
So that's kind of the problem, right? Is that a lot of these security issues have become
really
so complicated, right?
You know, when a Mac person asks me what kind of router I should buy, I don't say, oh, go buy that. I go get an Apple one. Mm-hmm. Because the tool administration is so easy with them.
Yeah.
But Ubiquiti also has awesome gear. Ubiquiti is a great company for wireless gear and
that's
routers.
That's kind of an awesome name.
Yeah, isn't it?
It feels a little bit disingenuous, I guess, when they were launching, right? Not very ubiquitous.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's Ubiquiti. Yeah, that's it, right? Oh,
Ubiquiti.
No, it's not Ubiquiti.
No?
Yeah, it is Ubiquiti, but it's not a Y. It's Ubiquiti. So it's Ubiquiti. Depending where you put the info.
Ubiquiti.
So let's go on to the next story, shall we, Mr. Jaffe?
Yeah, I wanted to just... I had a couple quick mentions, which we can elaborate more later because they're important pieces of information to get out before I cover my next one, which is AT&T and the T-Mobile merger has been blocked. Awesome. We can cover that maybe more later.
Wait, what do you mean?
Remember AT&T and T-Mobile? They were going to merge?
Yeah, why do you say awesome that it doesn't happen?
Well, because competition, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all love AT&T and everything, but...
Do you remember that AT&T graph of like AT&T being this monolithic thing and then splitting apart and coming back together? Have you seen this graph? I'll go find it.
That was AT&T bought them a couple of years ago. I used to have them as my carrier, but I don't remember the name.
Anyway, that deal didn't happen. Let's go on to something else.
May not happen, probably won't happen. And also, Steve Jobs stepped down as CEO of Apple, and Tim Cook is stepping up. But I wanted to read some listener feedback.
Okay.
Dear geeks, and this is posing a question that maybe we can answer.
Oh, so we actually are doing questions today.
We are doing questions. One question, yeah.
If you've emailed us yesterday, then we can answer your question.
Maybe. Okay, dear geeks. First, I have to say that I love the show. I listen almost every week. Recently, I had a problem with my Mac. I booted from a volume with the OS X Lion installer on it, but I didn't start the install. I just booted into it, and then I decided to reboot back into my normal hard drive, which was running Snow Leopard.
Okay, so this person had a Snow Leopard machine, decided to try Lion, but then after booting the install process, decided to cancel it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when I tried to reboot, the computer no longer saw my hard drive at all and refused to boot.
Oh, that's not good.
Upon running Verify Disk from the installer volume, I discovered that
CD. No, it's not a CD, though. How does the new volume exist?
Presumably, this person had taken the disk image and put it on it.
So they're doing something that's not exactly suggested, because the way that's suggested...
Well, you can do that.
Is to use the App Store and... Okay, but go on.
You can burn it to a CD. CD versus hard drive volume, same thing, right?
Okay.
Upon running Verify Disk from the installer volume, I discovered that the entire file system on the hard drive had been corrupted. How could this happen? I thought booting via an installer disk should be a passive action, one that shouldn't touch any of my hard drives unless I told it to proceed. Any thoughts?
Yes.
Any thoughts, or will this remain an unsolved mystery? Ben from California.
Okay. All right. First off, I want to say that that's not a suggested supported thing from Apple. Apple's suggestion to upgrade to Lion is this. You install App Store, which is actually part of one of the Leopard patches. Snow Leopard patches. You install the App Store. Then you go and buy Lion through App Store and downloads and does all this magic for you, and you never do anything.
Yeah.
They're already kind of assuming that you're making that step because you had to purchase it to do it.
They're not
doing standard protocol of this kind of thing. So I would assume that it's because Apple isn't following the rules that the encryption happened. It's also possible that something really wonky happened, just coincidentally. Ben, do you have Leopard on your machine yet?
You mean Lion, right?
Lion, sorry.
You're getting all the cats confused. Come on.
Gosh.
Get it straight.
And we talked about Panthers earlier, didn't we?
We can say 10-7 versus 10-6.
That's your Panther, remember? So 10-7,
that's going to be like
Lion.
The awful running joke.
Do you have Lion on your machine now?
I do have Lion on my machine.
Okay, so how'd you get it on there? And did you corrupt your system? tell us, how did you use the App Store?
Actually, I had the exact same issue as this person because I am this person. It turns out this actually happened to me. I am completely stumped. I was hoping that you would have some maybe it's because of... But it just seems to me like Apple is doing something funky, not following the normal, the expected rules, right?
Right.
Maybe when you boot into the volume, it does something onto your hard drive.
So. What Apple's doing is remotely replacing the kernel.
I mean, sure.
And it does in real time. It doesn't reboot, right?
What they're technically doing, is technically very cool, you know?
Yeah.
How they're doing it, I'm not sure. And that's probably at the basis of what happened. If you go...
When did you cancel the process?
If you go the normal... I booted into the installer. I actually went to go through the process. I intended to upgrade to Lion, and I had backed up, so all my files are safe and everything.
Right, sure.
and that doesn't matter. But I had backed up and everything, and I was going to install Lion, but for some strange reason, and about a month ago, I was having serious permissions issues and everything, so I reinstalled Snow Leopard. It said that my volume was locked, and I couldn't install Snow Leopard on the hard drive with everything that I had. So what I eventually had to do was I was going to reboot, unlock my hard drive, and then boot back into the Lion installer, install it, and then everything would be good. But what actually ended up happening was, of course, it farted at me, and I
wait,
and then
so
I
what
had
you're
to,
saying is you're going to run it, but it said the hard drive was locked,
yeah,
and couldn't do it, and so
I was going to reboot my normal operating system,
yeah, but it damaged the hard drive even though it was locked.
Yeah,
that's the weird thing.
Somehow it damaged the hard drive, and it wouldn't boot at all. It wouldn't even recognize that the hard drive
had a file system on it.
Yeah,
I mean you couldn't even mount that at all.
No,
yeah. So I'm not surprised in some ways because it seems to me that the way to deal with installing a new operating system inside another operating system is to move the partition around a bit and actually.
No.
Change things around.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
You could just copy, you could download the disk image onto the actual hard drive.
Yeah,
and then you
ask
could.
The system that had Snow Leopard, was it running? Was that the main hard drive?
Yeah.
How is it locked? What does that mean? How do you?
I'm not sure. I mean, my guess is that it was owned by someone it shouldn't have been owned by, or
right.
something like that. You know, like
right permission. Yeah,
CH
right.
mod, blah blah blah.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend CH not owned. Doing it that way. I'd do it the way Apple does. Now, at the university, we can actually download a disk image and install from the disk image, mm-hmm. because in a large academic space, you can't just go to every single machine and run it.
But that's effectively what I was doing.
So the big thing is back up before you upgrade.
Exactly. Okay. And that's what I did, and I'm happy. And speaking of Lion, I thought I would just throw out a couple thoughts because, I mean, I did not intend at all to upgrade. And then I randomly, on a whim, decided to try it. I made a bootable backup and everything. I was going to install Lion. If I didn't like it, I would just restore back to Snow Leopard, right? Because I had some time one night. But a couple new things. There's a really new revolutionary feature that I really love in Snow Leopard, and I'm really amazed that Apple implemented this. You can click and drag to resize a window from any corner now.
That's awesome.
Something that maybe Windows has had since Windows 3.1 or before.
Or 1.
Since Windows 0.
We're talking about like in a Mac. Like the one I'm using Snow Leopard still. The only place to resize the window is the bottom right-hand corner.
So you have to, yeah.
And what's really frustrating is iTunes right now on my machine is always larger than my default screen. It's as big as my plug-in monitor. I can never resize the thing.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. So anyway, finally, that's good.
Good.
One frustration I have is, so if anyone's a keyboard shortcut junkie like me out there, you'll know in System Preferences in Leopard and Snow Leopard, let's say that you're in the displays preference or something, and you want to go back up to see all of your preferences.
Uh-huh.
The keyboard shortcut for that is Command Up. So you press Command Up, and then you start typing to search for the one you want to go to. But during the animation, it doesn't get your keyboard input. So you press Command Up, and you try and type sharing, and it gets S ring. You know, like that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that really, really annoys me because I don't want to have to wait for my computer to complete an aesthetic animation in order to make it work. Unfortunately, they did not fix it. In fact, they made it worse. So anytime you're switching between windows, there's this nice animation and it's really pretty and everything. But I work a little bit faster than the animation goes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just switch over and I start typing or whatever before I even see the window.
Too fast.
And yeah, but the problem is it doesn't cache my keystrokes and then spit them out once the animation is done. So that's really frustrating. I hope.
Can you turn off the animations?
That. Not currently. Mm. No.
I'm sure there's a way to do it.
You can turn off certain animations, but not through System Preferences. You have to go and type stuff in the terminal.
Now, isn't there a new update of Lion already? Lion 1 or something?
No, I don't know that it came out.
Oh,
no.
Okay. I thought it did.
But anyway, so that's kind of a pain. They have, it very much feels a little bit more like iOS, but it's not lacking in functionality, which is really good. But they have spell check turned on by default. I'm not sure that you can turn it off from System Preferences. So like if you type var or something space in your coding, then it might change that to vat or something
like that.
I'm sure
you can turn that off. That would drive me insane.
It's so insane. You can turn it off via a terminal command. I don't think it's in the System Preferences. I might eat my words and be wrong about that.
Is it one of those things when you type var and it changes it to vat, can you do a control Z right after that and have it switch back?
Yeah, if you're looking at the screen, but sometimes, like,
it's interesting because I kind of like that feature of the iPhone. I start getting used to it, right?
But it's because you have to type so slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have to be staring.
Kind of want that. You have to stare at it.
The screen is your input
device.
Yeah,
it doesn't work so well when you're not staring at it. So they need to use the camera on the screen to find out if you're staring at it or not.
Yeah, I would trust that technology.
Especially I'm putting in my password.
Also, Expose is now Mission Control. Basically, they took Expose and Spaces. They merged the System Preferences panels into one called Mission Control, and they've removed 3/4 of the features.
Oh, so how wonderful!
It's lovely.
Do you get sarcasm?
So, yeah. So basically, it's the feeling I generally get with this is less control, but also less management. Most people would rather have it manage all this stuff for you.
I'm not going to Lion yet.
Yeah.
Here's another reason.
You don't need to. Also, your spaces are all in one long row. You can't go up and down anymore. So you don't have a two-dimensional grid
spaces. Are those multiple desktop ideas, right?
Yeah.
Where you have a browser in one, a mail, and you can switch between them. I don't use them much, but I think that's going from left to right makes a lot of sense rather than a full grid because you can get confused in a grid.
Yeah, unless you know how to use
our friend Scotty,
Yeah.
He has like 20 spaces.
Yeah. Well, doesn't Dung have
like 3x3?
No, Dung has a ridiculous number of spaces. Oh, really? And he does every diagonal one. You know, like the way
why?
I know. Like
I love it.
Like the way a the way
Tic-tac-toe?
No, oh my god, what's the chess piece?
Connect 4?
That's next to the
rook?
The rook is the one that's diagonal, right?
The bishop is
the bishop. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the bishop moves. So in order to get from one space to another space, at least when I last saw his desktop, he would have to move over and down, over and down.
Right. Another reason not to update to Lion. There's the Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, or LDAP, is this ability for machines to do directory access, meaning like if I want to know Ben's email address or phone number, I can look him up in the system and say, hey, Ben, I want Ben's phone number. And it would give me back the phone number. So it's a way of getting that kind of information. It also has authentication built in. So in a server environment, when you're logging into a server, you have to have a big collection of people that are managed. And so what we do in a Mac world is we make an open LDAP directory service, which has all the usernames and passwords and some information about them. And so when a person tries to log into their FTP access or SFTP access to modify the machine, they use the username and password credentials, and it goes and looks it up on LDAP on is it Open Directory or Open LDAP on the Mac. And the problem with Lion is that when the username and password is sent in LDAP, it goes, yeah, that's cool, and it doesn't really matter what the password is. It just always says, yeah, that's cool. So you get slight problem.
Oh,
now you can mitigate
man.
This by modifying some of these settings, but that's out of the box. And in the recent 10.7, so Leopard 10.7.1, they didn't address this problem. They didn't fix this.
So, okay, so it must have just come out.
Yeah, right. I think so. And the patch says that it's the release 10.7.1 fixed audio, video, and Wi-Fi glitches. So there's some stuff that it fixed, which is, of course, I never upgraded the operating system until they've got the first 0.1 release. So I was kind
Wait
of ready
for
to
point
do it.
Two.
It sounds like it.
Oh, God.
So not a good choice from Apple. The thing that's so frustrating about this is that there's a constant debate about, you know, what kind of operating systems to use. And one of the things that Mac seems to do pretty well about...
Apple,
seems to do pretty well is security. And this is an instance where they're failing miserably and they're not fixing it. And that's kind of frustrating.
You know...
But then again,
I
they're the biggest
feel
guy
like,
on the block now, so maybe they don't care.
I kind of feel like Apple doesn't do as well with security as they should. I mean, I remember covering a story, it was like a year and a half ago, though, so I'm not sure if this has changed, but Microsoft patched vulnerabilities a lot faster than Apple did.
Yeah.
And most companies did faster than Apple did. I think one of the issues, or one of the reasons that Microsoft still gets pummeled and Apple doesn't really, is that Apple is still a relatively small player. You know, as far as
in the desktop, space,
as far as desktop, as far as operating system.
And keep in mind, Apple's the largest company in the world.
Most valued company in the world as of our last episode.
Yeah,
more than ExxonMobil. I'm not sure that that's that may have changed.
Yeah, so, it's possible. Who knows?
Yeah. So we should, but
to say they're a small player.
Well,
but you're saying a lot of their sales are in all this other stuff.
Oh yeah, mobile is their honeypot. It's not OS X, and it's not Final Cut Pro either, especially after they released Final Cut Pro 10.
They released Final Cut Pro, old one, again.
Did they really?
Selling it. Yes. It's very exciting.
Oh, thank goodness.
Now, what they said is, well, we have all the CDs on hand, so we want to get rid of the CDs. So maybe they're
well,
not
they better make some more, because...
The new Final Cut is horrible.
Final Cut X. Yeah. iMovie on steroids, kind of.
But without the features.
Without iMovie on steroids, kind of. It's, you know, actually, was it iMovie 07 HD used to be really good. And then Apple realized, oh boy, we just released a piece of video editing software that's better or that's as good as Final Cut Pro,
yeah.
At least mostly, right?
So they broke it.
So they broke it because no one was going to buy Final Cut Pro if everyone could buy iMovie. And ever since then, iMovie has been
so
a steaming...
It's been bad. The new iMovie's bad. The new Final Cut's bad. The older iMovie was a great app. And... It had an ability to make plugins. Not that they supported necessarily, but they were great plugins. All these video plugins that made it, like, you could spend a couple extra $100 on plugins and have a Final Cut comparable system, but easier to use and more fun, all that stuff. The other thing that was awesome that Apple broke was QuickTime. QuickTime 7 Pro.
The other thing that was awesome that Apple broke, QuickTime 7 is still around. And
I use it all the time.
I thought, I was really scared that they would ditch QuickTime 7
in line.
You got
it to move in line?
Yeah, it's still there. It's still there.
So when
it's still hidden away in the utilities folder. But basically, every time I install a new operating system, I have to go through, find an MP3, an M4A, an M4V, all of these media files, and tell iTunes to not be the default to open it, and QuickTime Player
QuickTime
X not
7,
to be.
QuickTime 7 Pro, little app. When you and it was up
feels
at one point it was free. The one thing that's wonderful about it is that it opens image sequences, so you can do time lapse work. That's how I always do my time lapse work. You can copy a video file and paste it into an audio file, and it will stretch the video to match the audio, which is awesome for time lapse stuff. You can resize stuff, re-encode things, pull out sound files out of it. It's
and if you
cool.
press if you press Command K, you can change on the fly the brightness, the tint, the contrast of the video, so you can see it better. Maybe
that's
in
right.
a low light
so
situation,
if you got like a dark video. Yeah.
And for the audio, you can pitch shift it. You can change the treble, the bass. You can make it faster.
And
you can make
windows
it slower
that too. You don't have to use it by Command. There's
twice
windows.
Speed, thrice speed, half speed.
It's really cool.
Listening to podcasts. I mean, it's awesome. And now they've got QuickTime X.
So. Why don't you do like a geek literature thing, and then I'll do a geek frustration software thing, and then we'll finish the show that way.
All right. I've been reading Oscar Wilde lately. I love Oscar Wilde.
You geek.
I love Oscar Wilde. For someone who had such a horrible life, he wrote some incredible prose, and I love this one because it's really poignant. Children begin by loving their parents. As they grow older, they judge them. Sometimes they forgive them.
Ooh, nice.
I love that quote.
I like it too. Thank you. I've been really frustrated with Adobe PDF forms. Everyone seems to think that the thing to do with a PDF is to add all the Adobe special feature stuff to make it a form. And then you can have the content be emailed to you, which just sounds great. So you put up a web form, you put up a form, which is a PDF document. The user goes online and downloads the form, and then they fill out the form, their text, and they push submit. And that confirms that, yes, this person's really submitting this form. And then that thing gets emailed to the user. There's a whole different, lots of ways to do this. It's confusing. And I keep on running into spaces where it's frustrating. And one of the biggest frustrations is that now forms that I have to use are going this direction, the PDFs, and Macintosh's default reader can't see these things. You have
preview.
You have to use Adobe Reader to deal with these things. And Adobe Reader is horrible. It's so slow.
And Preview is really amazing, except for this one shortcoming.
Yes.
Preview is one of the most... You can also re-encode. It's kind of like what we were saying with QuickTime. Same thing with Preview and...
Which is the built-in app that reads PDFs in a Mac environment. So the thing...
All image files.
Yeah, and all image files can read it. And, you know, if you grab
animated
a whole bunch
GIFs.
If you grab a whole bunch of images and you select it in the Finder and then you drop it on Preview, it'll open in one window and then you can do a slideshow with it.
Yeah.
It's a great little
These
app.
Small apps that no one
the
ever talks
reader
about.
Reader is so bad. It's so clunky and... slow. One more thing I want to mention, though, about Acrobat. If you're on a Macintosh environment, you don't need to use Adobe's products to make a PDF. You can make a PDF from any application. You just go to print, and then from print, there's a little button in the bottom that says save PDF.
Bottom left.
I love that feature, and I use that because I don't like launching Adobe's products. Is that mean of me or what?
Yeah, and that's a good way of saving a website, too.
That's true. Hey, look, we're coming to the end of the show. I hope we gave away the tickets for next week's show. I want to mention that you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence, and we use with permission. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com.
We had a winner.
Yay.
And they were fast.
What was the answer to that question?
They were 2 minutes faster than everyone else, 21 million light years away.
Which is M101, and there's a supernova right now, so make sure you go see it.